Welcome back to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for software engineering leaders. I'm your host, Aaron Sahn. In today's episode, we're going to cover a really interesting and tricky topic, mergers and acquisitions. As engineering leaders, these can be the most exciting and most disruptive parts of your career, and they will certainly challenge your leadership skills. My guest, Mona Sabe, is incredibly experienced in M&A transactions for tech companies, and she'll share with us insights that will help you prepare for and excel in your role during M&A. This knowledge is going to help you both as an individual and your company. So let's get to my interview with Mona.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
Mona Sabe is a business strategist with a track record of building technology businesses from start to exit. With over 20 years of experience in Silicon Valley, her leadership extends beyond the C-suite, serving on multiple boards and advisory boards. In the past, she was Chief Corporate Strategy Officer at User Testing, where she closed four acquisitions and helped lead the company's $100 million funding round and took the company public on the New York Stock Exchange. Mona's passionate about inspiring others to, quote, play a bigger game, and is a co-founder of multiple groups that champion female leaders and diversity in tech, law, and policy. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Mona.
Great to be here, Aaron.
It's wonderful to have you join me. Thank you so much. We're going to talk today about mergers and acquisitions, and in particular, the impact on engineering leaders, how they can help support those. So I want to start with a question for you. What is the biggest mistake that engineering leaders make related to M&A deals?
Well, you know, the thing about engineers is they are the innovators, right? They're the ones who create the foundation that creates the value for a tech company. But whereas engineers are, you know, great at creating things, and engineering managers who have had experience over their career have had a lot of experience developing their roadmaps and listening to customer needs, the thing that they don't have much experience in is corporate transactions, right? They're not corporate transaction experts. And that's because acquisitions tend to be experienced only by a few engineers and then only once or twice throughout their careers. Whereas in the corporate side of things, the area where I play in, I mean, I've done over 50 acquisitions over the course of my career. So it becomes a little bit more, you know, natural for me. But the thing is, when a company is in the middle of one of these acquisitions, it tends to take a team by surprise, not just engineering teams, like all teams. And I believe that there's a better way to run an acquisition. Too many companies do it wrong. So when, I guess what I would say is that oftentimes companies treat acquisitions as a transaction that might happen. And I believe the companies need to start learning, and engineers can help them, treat acquisitions as a strategy that a company prepares itself for. So I guess I would say that the first, in answer to your question, the biggest mistake really starts with the company itself and their approach to an acquisition, whether their approach is more transactional or more strategic. Now, with that context, and before I maybe sort of talk about mistakes that engineers might make specifically, I think it's important to start by understanding the most common reasons why companies even get acquired, because, you know, similar to the importance of understanding what your customer wants before you start actually building a product, you really need to understand what acquirers want before you start figuring out what the right thing to do is, or maybe what mistakes you might make along the way. So I've had it. Yeah, that makes sense, right? Sort of obvious, and yet a lot of times companies don't start with that perspective. So anyway, I've categorized the reasons why a company might want to buy a target company into what I call five gaps. Very similar to, you know, when in the product world you talk about pain points that you're trying to solve for when you're building a product. So these gaps are a talent gap, a product gap, and those are the first two that are most relevant to engineering groups. But then also sometimes a company will acquire another company because they have a revenue gap or an opportunity gap or a profitability gap. So those would be the five that I like to categorize it. Now, for tech transactions, the engineering team is usually incredibly critical from the talent gap perspective. And sometimes you hear these kinds of acquisitions being called acqui-hires, which means that an acquirer is acquiring a company largely for the team, usually in this case, a technical team, so the engineering team. But that's not really the only kind of acquisition where filling a talent gap is important. So when the acquirer is driven by like any one of these four gaps, think about it, even if they're looking for revenue or opportunity or profitability, obviously, it's the team that needs to stay after the acquisition in order to continue delivering that part of the combined company, right?
Right.
And if it's a tech transaction, it's the engineering team. So with that, does that make sense then as far as the context goes?
It does, absolutely. Yeah, it's tremendously helpful. And it makes sense that those talent and product gaps would be the ones that the engineering teams have the most direct impact on.
Right.
But I really like what you just said too about the importance of them, kind of, especially in a talent acquisition, obviously they have to stick around, but even in the product acquisition, that's going to be incredibly important to continuing the product successfully. And so that helps drive home the point that the more prepared the engineering leaders are, the more that the company has set them up as this being a strategy, not a transaction, and prepared them for it, then the better off we're going to be. So yeah, no, this makes a lot of sense so far. Thank you.
Awesome. So with that and exactly what you said, one of the big mistakes that I've seen, maybe companies make, probably less on engineering teams, but maybe some engineering managers, is that when they're building their team, they think that they can sort of just build the minimum amount, like not a full engineering team, with the theory that, oh, well, we're getting acquired. The acquirer's company will have engineers that will cover this, right? That's a big mistake, because how many times has an engineering team said something like, yeah, I can easily take on that other group's engineering project. Yeah, I mean, and still do my projects on the side. Like there's literally, doesn't matter where you go, you can go to a mega cap company and all the engineers are busy working on their own projects. You acquire another company, you need those engineers to be there to continue working on the project. I think a similar mistake along those lines is when smaller companies contract out for some of the engineering work to be done. Contractors aren't necessarily going to definitely stick around post-acquisition. Right. Right. And if it's part of your core tech, now I'm all for contracting out because it also saves some money sometimes if you just got like a peak, you know, amount of work to do. But if it's part of the core of your technology that an acquirer cares about, it's going to essentially devalue the acquisition. So another probable mistake that a lot of companies make, especially the smaller ones I see when we're looking to acquire them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think some of the companies I've seen get acquired and knew that that was their path right from the start were very careful about working with us. In that case, we were an outside contractor to them, that they were working on the core functionality. We were working around it in a way that, you know, we were not impacting the necessarily the core value of the application, but helping support them in everything else that needed to be done so that they could really focus on that and, you know, creating the most value there possible for the company that was to acquire them in the future. So definitely seeing that strategy, that makes a lot of sense. I've seen others say, you know, kind of different perspective of that, well, by contracting a lot prior to the acquisition, we have a more flexible workforce, which maybe is helpful, but that sounds like that leads in a little bit to a mistake you were hinting at there, I believe, of kind of assuming that a lot of the engineering team can leave after an acquisition, and that's not typically going to be the case, right?
Yeah, and most of the, and again, I've spent my entire career in the tech industry, and you know, where we're talking about tech acquisitions, you're talking about acquiring the tech product, and in most cases, the biggest area where the acquiring company is doing diligence on is the engineering team. Unless for some reason, the reason why the company is successful is because of their brand, let's say. You know, you can think about, for example, when Apple bought Beats, you know, the that was very likely a brand-based acquisition, arguably not as terribly successful for the price paid, but we'll put that for another day. The other thing that we've always been very focused on when we are interviewing in diligence an engineering team is that we want to see if the team has been together for a while, hasn't had a ton of turnover, and can consistently deliver on time. And that's obviously something that companies care about just internally for internal operations, but I don't think they map that onto how it creates value in an acquisition. Because if I have to then go and hire a bunch of replacement people, because I expect that they're all going to turn over within a year, well, we all know how hard it is to, you know, hire people and then make them work well as a team and also deliver consistently and on time. And so having that history really adds, I guess, simplicity to the diligence process.
Yeah, no, I like that. And I think that's a really important observation about the importance of the team having been together for a long time, delivering work regularly, having gelled as a team and delivering the product, that, you know, maybe that's more important than employment status versus contract status, but, you know, how has this team been working together? And, you know, if they ramped up a bunch of contractors in the 3 months before acquisition just to sort of look busier or something like that.
And then sometimes contractors will stick around and they've always wanted to be an employee. And you can bring that in as an explanation for why you have the contractor there. So it's not as simple as contractor versus no contractor. You know, that's all talent gap side, but there's also, I said, product gap and how important that is in an acquisition. And obviously, you know, I mean, engineering has a huge impact on the product and what that looks like. But experienced acquirers, what they know is that oftentimes tech acquisitions will fail, not because the business wasn't successful before it was acquired, but because it didn't successfully integrate, right, into the buyer's business. And when you think about integration from a product perspective, you start thinking about things that I think a lot of companies and engineering managers don't often think about in the context of an acquisition. So, but when we've acquired companies, sometimes we've found that the tech stacks, this is pre-doing many, many deals, right? Acquirer, right? You acquire a company and then you realize you're operating off of two different tech stacks. When you operate off of two different tech stacks, what eventually happens if you're trying to integrate the two products together is you have to practically rebuild one of them. And that, again, it just takes the entire value out of everything you paid for, because in theory, the point of it is that you were going to get to market faster by acquiring instead of building the product yourself, right? Another thing I've seen engineering teams make a big mistake on is maybe not setting up the architecture of the product so that you can easily API pieces in to the acquirer's product. So you've got a product and maybe it has five services and the acquirer has a huge platform, you know, with a million services, let's say, and they want to be able to take a piece of each and API it into their part of the greater platform. Being able to set up your architecture so that that's successful and being able to talk about it in advance of an acquisition, it really makes a difference as far as setting a company up for a successful acquisition.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that point about having a flexible architecture or it's microservices or whatever style you want to call it, but something that's, you know, API driven and can be easily integrated with something, even if it is a different tech stack, at least the systems can be integrated more easily, is really important. So that brings up a question that I, you know, wanted to ask from the engineering manager's perspective. You know, something, regardless of whether there's a, you know, a transaction on the table or not, engineering managers are often dealing with balancing technical debt, legacy systems with new features to be developed. If as an engineering leader, you know that they're, you know, the company is looking to acquire others or you're looking to be acquired, whatever the case may be, does that change how you would balance it? Like, you know, if you have a fixed set of, time to work on something, should I spend it on maybe fixing some of that technical debt, making the APIs more open, more easily, you know, integrated with the person acquiring us? Or should I spend my time working on new features that, you know, maybe the business is going to say, but hey, these are going to add more revenue streams. These are going to drive up the value of the company in some form. You know, is there a good way to approach that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's complicated, right? Because the reason why a lot of venture capital companies don't like startups thinking about acquisitions is because it'll take their eye off the ball of just selling to customers.
Just build a business.
Just build a business and it'll come. I don't necessarily believe that that's true. I think that the reason why VCs say this is because it serves their purpose. If you've got a portfolio of 100 companies and one of them explodes and, you know, becomes a decacorn, then it doesn't really matter if the others die. But right. It matters to you in that other company right. that may or may not die. So I always say that, you know, if you're a founder, you need to think like a founder, not like a VC. I think that there's definitely got to be a balance. You've got to be able to build your business. You've got to be able to generate revenue. And that means whatever your customers need at the time. You know, the way I think about it is when you're very, very early stage, you can't worry about technical debt. You have to be able to, you know, sort of the wizard behind the purple curtain. You have to be able to deliver right. something that works from the outside as fast as you can and, you know, hack it together until you know that you've got scale and traction and the ability to deliver your product at a price point that will eventually one day hopefully drive profitability. And that's sort of an early stage approach. An acquirer looking at a company like that, you know, at different levels in your journey as a startup that's growing, you are de-risking an acquirer's acquisition of you in different ways. So I think looking at it from a de-risking perspective is really important. If you're a small company, you don't really have that many customers, they're probably buying you for your team and your product. And so you just want to prove that the product works and, you know, you're still going to have to develop it. Your engineering team is probably going to have to be the team that does that. So make sure that you've got a team that's going to stick around. But you just want to prove that the product is wanted by the market. You know, they're not buying you for your customers if you've got 12 and they've got 1,000. So I wouldn't worry about technical debt as much there as being able to show that you've got that. You're de-risking that. And what I mean by de-risking is we all know that, you know, it takes many, many iterations before a product is successful in a market. And acquirers know this too. And so they're trying to decide, should I build my own? But then I'm going to have to try it out and it might not work the first time and it'll probably take me 2 years. Or can I buy this product that you've got 20 customers and it's clear that you've de-risked that part of my thing. Now, you know, I recognize you're still going to have to build it and automate it and get rid of the technical debt. But think about a company that is later on in its growth stage, and now you do have, you know, 100, 200, 500 customers. At that point, you better not have a lot of technical debt, because if you do, most likely, you're not going to be able to achieve profitability. And the de-risk there is being able to get new customers at a profit for the acquiring company. And so technical debt becomes really important. And also, you'll probably find that a lot of your features will overlap with the acquirer's features, and you don't need to have everything. I worked at one of my companies in my history where we had four different engines that all did the same thing, but it's just because we kept acquiring more and more and the underlying engine was the same and we couldn't, it was very inefficient, right? So I think that in that particular case, you want to start being more careful about, especially if you're getting close to thinking, you know, this company might be 2 years away from getting acquired. We're probably not going to go public. Everybody wants some sort of exit, right? You want to start being more thoughtful about adding new features if they're not going to add any additional value to your acquiring company.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so this really highlights to me the importance of strong collaboration between, say, the CEO, the chief product officer, with the engineering lead too, because you need to both sides of that discussion, so to speak, need to understand the stage of growth that the company's at and need to understand that, okay, you know, we're in that early stage where we're just trying to find product market fit. So some technical debt's okay. Speed is most important. Rapid testing with our customers, super important. But then having the same people realize when they need to start to make that mind shift of okay, you know, we're at a different stage of growth now. We know we've got a good product that the market likes. So now we need to go back, address some technical debt. We need to think about integrations. You know, we need to think about maturity of the process. And that can be hard for the same people to navigate that change. So sometimes, you know, right, that's where you might start to see some leadership changes, right?
And I really do think you're right. I mean, two things to what you've just said. One is that, you know, it's not successful when you've got the corporate team or the corporate strategy team in one corner thinking about strategy, and then you've got the engineering and the sales team in another corner thinking about selling to customers. It's just, and unfortunately, I've seen this happen a lot. When you can bring them all together and as a, you know, executive team, really sort of decide how you're going to manage a roadmap with customers against a roadmap to, again, a strategy in preparation for an acquisition, as opposed to, back to my original point, thinking about it as, oh, suddenly we need to get acquired. Let's deal with this transaction, which truly barely ever works, right? Sometimes it does, but it's not something you want to build a strategy around. It's really the difference. And being able to bring the product leader and the engineering leader regularly into that conversation. To your second point, I think that there are engineering leaders who are really excited about thinking along these lines, and there are engineering leaders who just want to build product. And for the engineering leaders that just want to build product, the idea of planning for an acquisition or, you know, even thinking about acquiring somebody else is really never top of mind. And then they tend to be more of a roadblock to potentially growing the company in either respect, which definitely there's so few companies that just build product and just get customers and then eventually just go IPO and then still just continue to be successful, that it's just not, in my opinion, a strong engineering leadership mindset.
Yeah. At a minimum, it certainly caps the growth for that person, you know, as an individual, right? That they can reach a level in the organization where they can focus on building the product, but they're not going to, you know, go to a next step of a more strategic decision maker. And maybe that's fine for them as an individual, but the organization needs to know that about them and, you know, see that in their growth plan and for the gaps that they have in their own leadership team.
Yeah. And again, I think that it's, if we can get people or leaders to get to that next level, which I've also seen a lot of really great product and engineering leaders manage to get to, they become critical in the strategy of the company and the success of that strategy.
I want to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, WebRTC Ventures. At WebRTC Ventures, our teams are experts in building live video into your web or mobile applications. We've literally built hundreds of them. We have over a decade of experience using both open source and commercial media servers in a wide range of industries, including telehealth, edtech, broadcasting, and more. We also publish a lot of helpful tips and industry interviews on our website and our YouTube channel. So be sure to check out webrtc.ventures, and we can help you build, scale, and deploy your video solution. Now, speaking of leadership, I want to go back to something earlier in your career. On your website, you talked about an early executive role that you had prior to the 2008 financial crisis and how you had to dramatically cut your spend and budget. And hopefully a merger and acquisition deal is something more positive, certainly, than the financial crisis in 2008 was, but might still trigger some similar discussions, similar spending constraints on engineering managers. I'm curious, what did you learn from that experience that you wish you had known before?
Yeah, that was a traumatic period of my life, but it was also one of the biggest learning lessons of my life. And so I guess retrospectively, I'm thankful I went through it. But you're absolutely right. In an acquisition, and again, I've experienced many of them, if it's a small one, generally speaking, you won't see these kinds of cuts. But if it's a fairly significant acquisition, There's always some sort of what we like to call euphemistically as cost synergies, which unfortunately usually means reducing the workforce of, you know, the combined company in some respect. This was a time that I had to cut my spend. I was told by my CEO that I had to cut my spend by 80%, which was insane. Oh, wow. I literally thought I might as well just quit. And it took me an evening and probably a bottle of wine to sort of say, okay, well, this is a challenge. Let me see how I can achieve this. And the biggest learning I got from that experience is that more people isn't often equal to more productivity. In a tech company, usually the largest spend is on its employees. And so if you're going to have to cut, especially that deeply, you're going to have to reduce your employee headcount. And it seems nearly impossible when you start thinking about it. And yet somehow once you get through it, if you get through it effectively, and it was very hard for us, you find that sometimes you're actually more productive rather than less productive. And, you know, more people tends to mean more processes that you have to put in place to make sure that everybody has sufficient constraints on how they operate, because you can't easily just sync with everyone every day. When you've got a 20-person company, it's pretty easy. You don't need processes. When you've got a 100-person company, suddenly you need processes. So now people are creating processes. They're following processes. They're auditing processes. You're doing all of that stuff instead of doing what everybody wants to do, which is just good work, right? More people also means more connection points, right? So if you think about a network diagram, adding more nodes, or in this case, if the nodes are the people, increases the connection points at like at a geometric rate. So we know this, but yet we still tend to feel like we need to have more and more people to increase our velocity for some reason. And then we're always shocked when velocity decreases instead of increases, right? It adds much more complexity and bureaucracy. So I think that's the biggest learning I found is that, and you see it over and over and over again, where you see a small startup team eclipse what a large team is doing in a larger company, just simply because, you know, they can do it. They're more efficient. We don't spend time after we did that. And then I've had to go through a few more of these since that 2008 crisis. What we ended up doing was really focusing on what we had to do that makes an impact, and stopped doing a whole bunch of things that we ended, for some reason, we just glommed onto doing before, but really wasn't moving the needle. We would come in to Monday morning meetings and say, what are we going to accomplish this week? And people would do this litany of stuff. And I'm like, nope, just three things, like top three things. If you do more, fantastic, but these three things have to get done by Friday. It added a level of clarity. And what's really unfortunate is that teams normally have to experience some kind of shock, like a financial crisis or something like that, or running out of cash before they start doing this. But And it's still true today. I find it very hard to get teams to just really just reexamine themselves just for the sake of doing it. You have to have some sort of shock hit you.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense and tracks with my own career and experience too, having worked through the dot-com bubble and burst, and then 2008, and then, you know, March 2020 and the pandemic and all of that. I mean, it's easy to think about hiring as a way to increase velocity when you're in good times. But for me, you know, those experiences all certainly left me with the lesson too, that, you know, we need to be thoughtful about how we do growth, and that focus that those sorts of crises force you as a leader, as an organization, as a team, you know, we need to carry that focus into the good times too. And not to say you don't grow in those situations either, but just, you know, being really thoughtful about it and careful about it will save you a lot of pain down the road for sure. So let's go back to talking a little bit about the due diligence process. And can you tell me a little bit more about the role that engineering managers in particular play in due diligence, and maybe the types of due diligence too, because you talked about product versus team due diligence. And I hadn't really been thinking so much about the team side of due diligence, but more, you know, the product itself. Is it architected well? But you were also talking about the team as part of that process.
Yeah. The diligence process, I always start when, if I'm on the acquiring side, I always start by apologizing to the leaders of the company that we're thinking of buying and saying, you know, for the next, whatever, 30 to 45 days to 60 days, you will go through something and you will hate me, but hopefully when we come out of it, we'll be friends again. It is just a painful process. A friend of mine who sold her company said it felt like a 2-month long colonoscopy. So, yeah.
Without anesthesia.
Exactly.
You don't get to just wake up.
Really something that nobody looks forward to. You know, overall, the reason why it takes, you know, months, 1 or 2 months, if it takes longer than 2 months, then if you're a company that's getting acquired, I would start getting nervous because that just feels like it's the company's dragging on and maybe has ulterior motives because you're really, you know, uncovering everything about your company. You want this to close quickly. But I have a diligence list that's 350 items long. That doesn't necessarily apply to every company, right? I'll reduce it if it's a smaller company, but literally 350 items long for larger companies. And it does include things like, you know, how do you build a product roadmap? Tell me about your last few product roadmaps. How have you, you know, measured against them? This is a question that I think a lot of engineering teams have challenges with. What are the key metrics that you use to manage your engineering team? So being able to come up with that in advance, I think. And it's always a nice surprise, but a rare find if you can get metrics that actually tie to revenue outcomes as opposed to just work done.
Do you have a good example of that or something that you would be delighted to see?
So usage by feature would be a really interesting metric, right? And some companies have it. Many companies, especially again when you're smaller, don't, because you know, if acquirer, it can hurt you or help you. If an acquirer cares about certain features of your products but not others, usage by feature either is going to really help you or really hurt you, depending on the usage and the feature.
Right.
Which is why it's important to know what the purpose of the acquisition is in advance of getting to diligence. So those are some interesting things. I think from an engineering perspective, questions like, you know, the team, who are the key team members? You know, again, when you're early in diligence, you might not want to give names, although in this day and age, people can usually figure them out, but you might want to give key roles so that you can understand who we want to make sure we retain. What do they work on? How large is the team? What have they delivered? How long have they been together? Those are sort of the operational diligence questions that, again, a sophisticated acquirer will ask. When an acquiring company just throws the diligence over to their legal team to handle and they're not thinking about it from an operational perspective, sometimes they won't ask these questions. But the legal team will always ask, and these are the two big legal issues that come up for engineering teams, is what third-party modules are in your solution, assuming it's a software solution, and what open source you've used. And if the engineering team hasn't been cataloging and regularly checking and managing an open source project, that open source question can lead to literally weeks of work for the engineering team to try and answer.
So with questions like that, that's a really good point that I wanted to understand better from you as well. For an engineering manager, when they face those sorts of build versus buy decisions, do I integrate a third-party SaaS solution that can do this work for us? Do I bring in an open source project? Or do I build this entirely custom so that, you know, we control it completely in-house and therefore, you know, IP perhaps is in-house too? Is there a right or a wrong answer to that from your perspective, or what factors go in? You know, would you like to see engineering managers incorporate in those build versus buy decisions?
Yeah, I mean, again, complicated, right? And it's not, it's certainly an art, not a science. I think that open source is a different analysis from commercial third-party solutions, whether you're embedding them or whether you're just using another service. So let's take open source first. I mean, everybody uses open source and software these days, so you can't get around that. But what engineering managers should be doing from the very beginning is having a process whereby their teams cannot include open source without, first of all, you know, categorizing them somewhere and making sure that and most engineers these days are fairly sophisticated about open source licenses. But if you're not, or if your team is not, or if you're hiring someone who's not, then they better go through some level of training, because the worst thing is having to take every single open source and send it to your legal department for review first. You can't operate. I mean, everything will grind to a halt. So just being able to know that certain licenses are fine and being able to categorize it, whether it's an Excel spreadsheet or you've got some sort of database or you've got actually, there's many open source tools out there that open source management tools that you can use, makes it much easier, because then engineering teams can sort of monitor themselves. They can decide, yeah, no, I'm going to use this because it looks okay. I'm not going to use this because it doesn't look okay. I know these things. Oh, this one I'm not sure about, I'll ask legal, but it's one in 50, not one in one, right? If you do that, then when you come to a diligence level, you're just giving them your database. That's all you're doing. And then the acquirer has the hard work of reviewing it all and deciding if it's okay or not. And then they might come back with questions. But if you've already got it all nicely set out, you know which module is in, you know how you use it, it's pretty easy. If you have none of that, you're basically taking a year of work and trying to compress it in a month. And that's it's definitely not fun.
Not fun.
Not fun. So I'm all for open source as long as it's managed well.
Yeah. What about SaaS-based solutions?
SaaS-based solutions, services, or even embedded solutions. So you're embedding it into your product and you're selling it as part of your product. That's a different story. I think there you really want to sort of combine, or, you know, if you're thinking about a matrix, you want to think about the technology need on, let's say, one axis versus your internal talent on the other axis, right? So if it's sort of a commodity item, everybody had to build a long time ago their own, you know, store on their website, and now that's become a commodity item. And if you don't have your available internal talent to do it, which why would you? Because it's become a commodity item, then no, go get that third-party service, right? If it's on the other extreme, something that is actually back to the strategy of your business, core to your business, right? It's innovative, or maybe it's not core to your business, but it is innovative and it could be core to your business in the future. This is where engineering leaders love to play, right? And you have availability of talent on your team. Let's say it requires in this world, you know, sort of some AI work, and you actually have, you know, AI experts on your team, which are, they're getting fewer and far between because they're getting gobbled up, then don't use a third-party solution, build it yourself. And then in between there becomes the art or science, and you can certainly go and find a commodity solution or pay for a third-party solution. Or if it's sort of somewhere in between, I think partnering is another option where it's sort of innovative. There's a few solutions out there, but not many. And you have enough expertise to be able to work with that solution, but not so much as to build it yourself, then going to find that other company and partnering with them so that there's more of an interesting revenue opportunity, I think, and also some APIs between your two companies, I think is sort of the middle ground between the two.
Yeah, I think based on our experience in our work as a service provider and sometimes helping our clients move from one solution to another, you know, I think if you've got a, say like a SaaS-based solution for marketing automation, then by all means, go use that. You know, there's others out there. You can replace them. It might be complicated, but you know, you don't want to build that, obviously. Things that are more integral to the operation of your application, like it's really important to think about, well, what happens if this company goes away? Is there an alternative in the marketplace? And, you know, is there something that we should be doing now that would make it easier to switch to them if we had to? Because, you know, it happens.
And definitely from a partner perspective, one company where they're the only other provider of that solution. That's a dangerous situation for you as a company.
Right, exactly. So we're starting to get towards the end of our time here, but I think one thing that's really important, you mentioned having a list for due diligence of, I think, 350 items on it. If I'm that engineering manager and you give me that list, I'm sure I'm going to have to go to other people on my team, right, to build that information, to provide all those answers to you. So to what degree, if, you know, say I'm the company potentially being acquired and I need help from across my team to perform the due diligence, to what degree as an engineering leader do I disclose to them, you know, why I'm asking them all these weird questions? Like, how transparent should that process be?
Yeah, such a great question. The biggest risk when a company is getting acquired is telling too many people in the company that it's happening. And the biggest reason why that's a risk is because if the acquisition doesn't happen, then you've got a lot of people that suddenly were motivated before this ever started and become incredibly demotivated after. It's the greatest employee disincentive program you can create. I unfortunately had an experience where I was helping a startup who had been approached by a very large mega cap company that we all know, but I won't name. And they were interested in acquiring it. This was a small company, maybe 50 people. And the big company, again, they wanted the product. It was very much a product and talent acquisition. They needed the talent. They needed the product. Or this is what they said. They took probably, first of all, 2 months just to get up to a term sheet asking a whole bunch of questions, which is a long time if you're approached, right, as opposed to whether you're trying to sell yourself. And then insisted on like a longer period of diligence. In that period of diligence, they cared a lot about the engineering team and they insisted on interviewing all of them. And we pushed back a number of times and waited and waited and waited until we felt like we were far enough along to the point where they had been telling us what the benefits were that they offered. And then we're like, okay, you can meet the rest of the engineers. And at the very last minute, the general manager of that division was fired and replaced by someone else. And they decided to walk away. So they had basically 50 people who knew about the acquisition and it had been going on for 4 months and they had been distracted from their business. And it was the hardest thing for the CEO to turn that company back around again. I give him an enormous amount of, you know, kudos for having been able to do it. Most people would not. It's like the death knell of a company. So all of that to say it happens and you don't know that it happens because nobody puts that on TechCrunch, right? I nearly got acquired and then I failed. Nobody says that.
Right.
But it happens quite frequently. And telling a lot of people on your team just means that a lot of people on your team could potentially get very disappointed if the deal doesn't go through, which makes it difficult for engineering managers because you have to be able to answer these questions yourself or maybe bring in your, you know, right-hand person, but try and keep it really small is always, I think, the better outcome.
Yeah. And I could see why you described that scenario as the biggest disincentive program that you could ever implement in a company. So let's close with the opposite of that, hopefully more positive. Talk for a moment about the personal impact that this can have on, say, a senior engineering manager. And what advice would you give to them as an individual in terms of either negotiating their compensation, you know, when they start in that role, if they think that that's a likely exit for them, or just preparing for it if they happen to be in on, you know, in on the discussion and know that it's coming. You know, what should they be considering in terms of their personal financial impact on this with stock options or other incentives?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. And what's really interesting is even in this world today, and I mean, I've been operating out of Silicon Valley for over 20 years, which you would think it would be stock option central. Engineers seem to care less about options than cash. Overall, my experience is they care more about their cash than about their options, which, you know, in my career, I can categorically tell you if you work at one successful company long enough, or if you work at many companies and, you know, some of them are good, you're going to generate wealth more from your options than you are from any revenue, like cash salary that you're going to get. But nevertheless, I see this over and over again. For, you know, people that are not on the leadership track, you know, I would just be focused on understanding what the current value of the options are and how your management considers what the possible future value of your options to be. In order to really get a, you know, be able to figure that out, you sort of start to need to know a little bit about how companies are valued, right? So oftentimes we'll talk about things like tech companies, an easy rule of thumb, not, you know, generally, can be valued at 5x revenue, for example. In the heydays, when everybody was getting acquired a few years ago, it could have been 10x revenue. When it was insane, it might have even been 15x revenue, but you shouldn't count on that because it's just, you know, it's like playing the slot machines in Las Vegas. But, you know, you need to have a little sense of what industry you're in and generally what revenue valuation you can get. You know the revenue of your company. You can ask questions like how many shares are there outstanding? You divide the revenue by the number of shares, you get the dollar price, and you're like, oh, okay, you know, maybe I want to ask for more options just in case we get acquired. So that's right. Your average. That's how I would be thinking about things. From an engineering leader's perspective, I think the most valuable thing you can do to negotiate your initial offer letter is ask for your options to become fully vested if you get acquired. I'm putting that in the offer letter. Now, many companies will just refuse to do that. Some companies will do it for like some leaders. Some companies will do it more broadly. You know, you have to decide how much leverage you have when you're talking to a company, but it's incredibly valuable because if you can negotiate that, then in an acquisition, if you've got a whole bunch of options, but they haven't vested, there's a possibility that they might actually get canceled, which would be terrible. That's a bad acquisition. Or they just roll over into the new company. So you still have the options, which is great, but you still have to, you know, wait until they vest right. Before you get the value out of them, which means you're there for a period of time. If they're fully vested, you can leave tomorrow or you can stay and get a new package, which is fantastic. Right. So these are the kinds of things that I think, again, I did my undergraduate degree in engineering, so I understand the thinking of very, very black and white, but there's so much gray in between. And for everybody's financial health, I think being able to understand a little bit of that gray is valuable.
Absolutely. Well, and we could do a whole episode just talking about that gray in between, but unfortunately we're out of time today. But Mona, I want to thank you so much for a really enlightening conversation. I really appreciate you sharing your expertise with myself and with our listeners. How can our listeners get in touch with you for more information about your work or any of the groups that you work with?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on LinkedIn. So that's usually where I respond. So reach out to me on LinkedIn. Would love to hear from everybody. Also, just a big plug, me and two of my co-author friends are about to publish a book called Sail to Scale, which is a lot about how to grow a tech company. And that's coming out on August 22nd. So
awesome. Thank you so much, Mona. I look forward to getting a copy of it. And perhaps we'll have an opportunity to discuss that again in the future. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Scaling Tech Podcast.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
On behalf of the thousands of developers we've placed with our clients, I want to briefly tell you about our sponsor, Agility Feed. Agility Feed has been building nearshore agile teams for U.S. companies since 2010. We were an early pioneer in doing this sort of developer staffing. Our team can help you recruit talented software engineers and technical teams in Latin America. We'll handle all aspects of recruiting, contracting, and payments for you so you can focus on delivering great software. To learn more, check us out at agilityfeat.com. That's agilityfeat.com.